Welcome to Popcorn Psychology, the podcast where we watch blockbuster movies and psychoanalyze them. My name is Brittany Brownfield, and I'm a child therapist, and I'm joined by...
Hannah Espinoza-Rimus, and I am a marriage and family therapist.
And Ben Stover, I am an individual therapist.
We are all licensed clinical professional counselors, also known as therapists, who practice out of Chicago. Even though we are licensed mental health professionals, this podcast is purely for entertainment purposes and to fulfill our love of dissecting pop culture in all forms. And today we're going to talk about A Wrinkle in Time.
Yes.
Which we just saw yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So I think most people are slightly familiar. It's a book a lot of people had to read in school. I had to read it in school.
I did too. I read it many years ago, probably fourth grade.
Yeah-ish. So I recently reread it because I didn't remember any of it because of that.
So did I.
And we saw the movie yesterday. So the general gist, it's about a girl and her brother who go on a fantastical adventure to find their dad in another planet. That's funny, it's succinct. With the help of three...
magical beings.
Yeah, metaphysical beings.
Yeah.
So, I mean, right off the bat, I thought it was a really magical movie. I really enjoyed it. Probably going to be some tears maybe even discussing it, because it was very affecting, I thought.
It was a strong emotional movie, for sure, and it had a lot of strong fantastical qualities to it. A lot of people were knocking the CGI use of it, mm-hmm. but I don't see how you would possibly create this movie without the CGI. So I had some pretty strong reactions to some of the critics being so harsh on that.
Like, there's like a 2000 miniseries that is like reviled, and I don't know if that's because it probably didn't have great production value because it was like a TV miniseries, and to try to do all this stuff that's in that movie worldwide. And not have, like, the CGI to back it up. It would probably look really...
really bad.
Never-ending story style?
That's not bad, but maybe.
I guess you could have been more Jim Henson-ing it than CGI-ing it. But anyway. So, I mean, the common things we thought when we watched it... Well, we're going to talk about each the three kids. Meg, Charles Wallace, and Calvin. And kind of the themes of trauma and loss, low self-confidence... emotional, being emotionally vulnerable, open, stuff like that. So, if we want to get into Meg first. So, Meg's the oldest kid. She's 14. And in the story, she loses her dad. And I think... Well, a big part of the story is that how she acts out because of losing her dad 4 years before.
Or and not how knowing where he was. And how she's different in her family. Like, she's also different among her family as well as being different in the school setting as well.
Like, thinking she has very common, I guess what I would call symptoms of losing a parent or having a big loss in your life as a kid. Like, her grades are really bad, especially compared to her ability, which is, they talk about it in the book, but in the movie, even, like, her principal is like, you can be doing better. And she, I think what's part of the frustration is that she knows she's smart in some ways, and she knows she could be doing better, but she can't get it together. She can't get her shit together to make her grades good. So there's that frustration there. Feelings of low self-worth combined with self-doubt, not being trusting, angry, defensive, acting out, kind of lashing out really, well, behaviorally, like throwing the ball at the girl's face.
Right.
Like not being able, like impulsive, like not being able to stop yourself from making a bad choice that's going to get you in trouble. And then shitting on yourself later for being like, why can't I stop myself? Why can't I make good choices? Why am I always getting in trouble? Why can't I get it together? That kind of cycle of acting out because you feel bad, like, and you also feel bad about yourself, and then it's like a snake eating its own tail, and then you act out on those feelings, and then you feel, and those confirm your feelings of, I am a bad kid, I am stupid, I can't get it together, why can't I calm down? Which, I mean, in the book it's more because you hear her inner voice a lot in the book, but in the movie too, it's just, it's kind of, she just thinks that she is trash.
She definitely feels very clearly that she has no self-worth and that she's not an important part of the school setting. She's not an important part of her family, even. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that she feels very disconnected and very alone.
Right. But all of that without really being vulnerable to that and without letting that in and processing and dealing with it. She just keeps, like, pushing it down, shutting it out and avoiding it, which also leads to what I just called the volcano effect, where, like, you can keep pushing stuff down and avoiding it and pushing it down and pushing it down, but it's going somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be released just because you're putting it, you can put dirt under the rug, but eventually there's going to be a lump from the amount of dirt you put there, and it's going to be visible, and you're going to have to take it out and deal with it. And I think that's when we later talk about our treatment focus, like one of the things that I think will be covered is like, dealing with that phenomenon that people have of avoiding things that are unpleasant, particularly in American society right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a really good quote in the movie where the happy medium says to her, it's okay to fear the answers, but you can't avoid them. And I think a lot of times when we act this way, it's very fear-based. Like, I can't deal with it. I don't know what will happen if I actually look at directly at the feelings I'm having. Because what she's feeling is very powerful and very correct and, you know, very deep and strong. Like, losing her father, not knowing why he's still missing, the doubt that maybe he's choosing to be gone, which I think is very powerful.
And other kids are using against her.
Yeah, and, well, she's being bullied at school about it, and just not wanting to look at it directly because, I mean, the way I always talk about it with people is kind of almost can feel like you're standing at the edge of a really dark hole, and if you finally acknowledge it, you'll fall in that hole and never feel like you can get back out of it. When in actuality, once you kind of just acknowledge it, the hole's usually not as big or not as deep. Like, you can get out of it.
Right. And you know? The other thing that I think people miss all the time is it goes back to the Will Rogers, you know, classic comedy routine about it. But the first step to getting out of a hole is to stop digging.
True. Oh, good one, Ben. I mean, and I think what's cool about this movie is it does a really good job of using fantasy and fantasticalness to address really big true things, like how they transport through space is by tessering, and how it seems like you can only really tesser properly if you feel love and if you can experience love and not just love for other people, which she does definitely have, Meg, is love for yourself. And so it does a really cool job in the beginning, two times they test her, where she's like choking on it and it's like black and it hurts her and she passes out and everyone else is like fine and she's like struggling because she can't connect to that part of herself that is confident that she deserves to feel love.
Right, and when they made it quite clear in the movie that, like, the ability to tesser the frequency is love.
I mean, it's a very sweet way of sending that message to, like, kids and adults, which is that how potent and powerful self-love is to being able to be balanced in the world. Literally, because there's that film, the part in the movie where you have to balance when they're at the happy medium and you have to literally balance on these boards and she can't do it. And she really can't do it when she has to think about her dad.
Right.
Because she can't face it and so it's whacked her all out of place.
Yeah, because a part of her feels, a part of her is missing. And so she can't feel balanced without it and she doesn't know what to do about it.
Yeah, I mean, missing her dad and also just like the fear of like, what if he really is gone because he doesn't want to be with us or something's more important to him than being with us, like finding the universe or like that he found something out there and it's not worth coming back to us for. And just, I don't know, the palpability of that belief possibly being validated for her like outweighs everything, which I totally get because it's probably, a lot of time in therapy, I, like, ask people what is, like, your, what's the big thought? What's the big fear?
Yeah, what's and the deep, what's the worst?
Because usually worst everything thought. Boils down to one big, deep fear. And it might,
or it's one usually, deep belief.
Yeah, and it's usually pretty simplistic, because people will be like, well, that I won't be able to have a good job. And I'm like, no, it's deeper than that. Go down to, like, the most common denominator. And it's usually something like, even my dad can't love me. And once people can really hit on that, though, it usually is a real tearjerker moment and can be very, like, usually once we get to that, like, that's all we do that day and, like, we calm down after that. But once you can kind of tap into that and realize where all the fuel is coming from, it's like awareness. It's like you're suddenly aware of why you're doing what you're doing and it kind of takes the shine off of it, like the scariness off of it. And once you see it, you're like, okay, that's where the motivation comes from or that's what's driving me to do these acting out behaviors, even with adults. Like, we're talking a lot about kids, but, like, adults, too. Like, arguing, lashing out, shutting down, avoiding relationships, all that stuff. I mean, she's a kid, but, I mean, all the behaviors she does is stuff that adults do as well.
It's stuff that everybody does.
Mm-hmm. because it's all just, she can't trust the world to work out how she wants, and she can't trust it enough to be vulnerable and to be open-hearted. I mean, even when Calvin, the other boy in it, who's obviously so smitten with her, gives her compliments.
She can't accept it.
Yeah, her first instinct is she gets weird and defensive and starts, like, shitting on herself.
Right, don't talk to me about my hair.
And she changes the subject.
Yeah.
Immediately. Oh,
yeah. Because she can't, because even though that's, like, a you think it's a positive, it's also, it's an uncomfortable space. And, like, people will be miserable if it's a comfortable misery. And accepting positives can be so different that it's so uncomfortable that that is, it negates all the
positivity. Well, I think it makes it really, it makes it really hard to believe anything. If you don't, if you don't trust yourself or love yourself, then it's really hard to believe or trust anyone else. And I don't think that that is something that is talked about very much in a lot of different ways. And I think one of the, my favorite things about this movie is that essentially what really saves Charles Wallace is the fact that Meg can finally accept herself and the strengths that she does have instead of only being able to look at the negative things.
Well, also I think what's beautiful is that she discovers, oh, it's gonna cry. She discovers that Charles, like, she can accept that Charles still loves her even though she is all those things.
Yeah.
He still loves her. And then she's able to test her after that. And it's so, that really choked me up more than I thought it would. When she tests her the last time, and it's very beautiful and colorful because she's able to finally accept love for herself and accept that she can be loved.
Right. And the symbolism of that in the story was really well done. And it's, it's really an important fact that even the three misses were able to communicate pretty clearly. And it was interesting to watch the way that, like, Reese Witherspoon's character, was she Wutsit? Was that?
She's Mrs. Wutsit.
Mrs. Wutsit was, like, so, like, confused and frustrated by her inability to adjust and adapt and accept the things that, like, she had viewed as, like, basic truths that Meg was, like, so closed off to and rejecting. Like, the ability to love yourself and to be in touch with the world.
Why can't you scissor? What's your deal?
Right.
Scissoring is, like, easy.
Right. It's, and cool, it's easy.
And good and positive. But I think that's a common thing when I work with, like, parents and, like, who have the kids who behave this way, when they're just like, why wouldn't they just do this, this, and this? Because if they could just do this, this, and this, their life would be a lot easier. And why can't they see that? Like, why do they continue to yell? They know if they yell, they'll get in trouble. And I think that's a common misconception of people looking from the outside at someone who's having all these feelings is being like, why are they ruining their own life?
Right.
Kind of thing.
Why can't they just stop it?
Why can't they see what they're doing? And it's because they're in that, well, one, because you're, what you're really doing is you're asking, why can't they accept this belief that is so contrary to the beliefs that they think are true? Like, to their heart's truth. I mean, it's almost as powerful as saying, why can't that person just stop believing in God?
Yeah.
Like, that's how real those beliefs feel when they're ingrained. Especially when you're a kid and your parents are your whole world. And your parents are what's,
help create your identity.
Help create your identity and are the foundation of how you can experience and receive love. And so when that falls apart, in whatever way it does, even in the situation where her dad doesn't choose to leave her and stay away from her, it forms so many cracks in who you think you can be and to what love you think you can experience and are allowed to have. Because you've decided because of someone's actions that you are unlovable. Even if it doesn't make rational sense, that's what you're feeling. I mean, and that's why she's so reactive. Because I think a lot of times, too, with kids, once they kind of get in that headspace, or adults, too, where I am, like, trash, you just keep perpetuating that because you kind of just give up. There's, like, a hopelessness to it.
Yeah.
Where you're like, well, I'm trash anyway, so I might as well punch that kid in the face because I'm already, everything sucks anyway, so I might as well just do what I want.
Right.
And it's also an example, too, I think, of the comfort that comes from knowing the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
There's some comfort in knowing that if I do this, this is what will happen, versus if I really process these feelings, I don't know what's going to be on the other end. Where if I know if I punch this kid in the face, I'm going to end up in the principal's office, which means I'm going to have alone time and I'm going to get away from everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's that whole idea of also having something that you can control when you feel like,
for sure,
when you feel like there's nothing you can control, it gives you something to control.
Well, right. I mean, to ruin something, to ruin a relationship, to ruin anything, you only need yourself. But yeah. for something to be built up and to be positive and to be beautiful, you have to trust other people and what they're going to bring to the table. And that, for a lot of people, is unfathomable and so scary that it's not worth it.
Yeah.
Right. And then you, like, their ability to trust and be open and vulnerable to someone else and to allow them to even have the chance to hurt them is something mm-hmm. that they can't tolerate. Like, they can't yeah. accept in their life, so they'll push away mm-hmm. the minute something gets close. They can, like, mm-hmm. shut down and push away or act out, because that way they can return to a situation they understand mm-hmm. and can adapt to, which is me alone with me and my feelings. Mm-hmm. Even if they're hard feelings, they're the ones I understand and accept and yeah. have been proven true to me, at least through the viewpoints mm-hmm. I am able to accept right now.
Well, I mean, it's the two thinking of one, confirmation bias, which is only seeing the things or only perpetuating the things that confirm what I already think about myself. And then the ideas of cognitive dissonance, which is when your thoughts don't match up. Like, when we experience cognitive dissonance, it's when something occurs that it's contrary to our belief. Like, the way I kind of think about it is when you hear something, like, hearing something and, like, your brain, like, statics out. Because yeah. your brain can't comprehend it. And it's, like, that discomfort. It's, I'm making a scrunched up face because it's, like, cognitive dissonance, when I see it visually, it's, like, a thought hitting your brain that doesn't make sense. So you're, like, what? And then you kind of, like, spaz out in your head. And then you just reject it wholeheartedly because it doesn't make sense. And a lot of times when people experience cognitive dissonance, they will get defensive, act out, lash out, shut down. Like, they can't deal with it. And because it's such an uncomfortable feeling, and they won't. It's really hard for people to work through cognitive dissonance.
Right. And
get to the other side of it.
It's very hard and takes a lot of work. And a lot of the problem with it is that they can't, because it's so contradictory to their fundamental truth mm-hmm. that they either can't see it at all, mm-hmm. won't accept it, or won't process it.
Because I would say that Calvin, Meg couldn't ask for a sweeter boy to have a crush on her. Like, he's so sweet to her. He's so open-hearted. He's so nice. He's given her compliments. He doesn't seem nefarious in any context. He's very tender. And she's just, every time he interacts with her, she gets cognitive dissonance. Because she's like, what are you talking about? Who the hell are you? Like, kind of like side-eyeing him. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't get what's happening here. And so she just shuts it down. Because it doesn't fit the puzzle in her head. And so she's like, whatever, dude. Like, ugh. And, I mean, bless him, because he keeps trying.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's a classic example of it, like, in the movie. And just all the stuff about how can I be the one to save him, like Charles Wallace, and, like, her inability to feel like she's an important piece of the puzzle. Which, unfortunately, Miss What's-It, like you said, kind of confirms it. Because she keeps saying, I don't get it, Charles Wallace. Why is she here? She doesn't get anything. She sucks.
Right, she's only willing to accept the person that accepts her
mm-hmm. I think
point of view in the world.
Yeah, I think it's a good example. The three different misses, I think, is a good example of, like, Mrs. What's-It is the kind of the doubting, the very pragmatic person that you talk to who can't reflect, who maybe struggles with reflecting feelings mm-hmm. and can't really. And then you have Mrs.
Who is Mindy Kaling?
Mrs. Who is just this kind of really sweet, loving person. And then you have Mrs. Witch, who is the person who holds all the feeling and all the emotion and can just look at her and say, I get it. Mm-hmm. I know that you can do it. Kind of that unconditional, what you talked about the last podcast, unconditional positive regard. I mean, that is the definition of what Mrs. Witch has for Meg.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So when we look at Meg, we see some pretty clear symptoms of a person who has dealt with a loss and
yes. yeah.
the trauma of that loss. But when we look at her, you see, at least in the way this movie represented, you see the more hallmark characteristics of depression with her.
Yeah, I mean, the grades going down, especially when you work with kids, that's a pretty clear indicator. Especially if the grades decreasing goes along with something else, either a life event or the starting of the symptoms. That's usually one of the biggest indicators when I work with kids about if there's a genuine issue going on. The acting out, the low self-worth.
A lack of enjoyment.
Lack of enjoyment in things. I also think that her struggling to kind of really be connected really to anything besides Charles Wallace. I mean, I think she has some symptoms that are pretty clear of what it looks like to be depressed and to kind of be stuck in the story that you tell yourself.
Well, she's very isolated. It doesn't seem like she has any friends at school.
She does not. She's very isolated, and that's those are all pretty clear markers of depression that that we see, and it was represented very well, I think, in the movie and in like the types of angles and lighting that they used to reflect her. It was really important that she had no belief in herself, and also like some undertones of guilt, like was dad leaving my fault? And with depression, especially in kids, one of the things you want to look for is it's not just like guilt, but inappropriate guilt.
Yeah, like taking on a lot of responsibility that
for
is
something
not yours.
That doesn't make any sense.
Like my parents got divorced because of me, or dad left because of me, and like stuff that, and it doesn't matter. And parents will like tell them, you know, contrary, like that's not because of you. But I think the depression just really, once it kind of locks in, it's really hard to lock it out.
Right, is it'll warp your thoughts.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's part of not being able to, how, the way that I describe it to people is not being able to see out.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see the light at the end. You can't even consider that there might be light at the end. There
which
just
is,
isn't anything there. It's
which
being
is what
stuck.
The movie
exactly.
Out, which
it's
is
visually,
finding the light.
Yeah, just finding the light and finding that part of yourself that is okay and is comfortable in that situation. Mm-hmm. I think that Meg. Also, another sign, another struggle that people have who suffer from depression is acting out in anger in other ways. Because anger is a much more acceptable social response in our culture. To be angry is much more acceptable from, especially from boys, but just in general, from people in general. And so I think having that reaction instead of being sad and being vulnerable and being upset and saying, look, I'm just really sad and confused about my dad disappearing.
Well, I mean, anger feels like a verb feeling. Like it feels like an action feeling, like a power feeling. Like when I'm angry, I can get stuff done. When I'm angry, I can punch. I can do something with that anger because it's such a visceral, because you have to kind of like expend it out somehow. So I think people misconstrue that for having some sort of control over their feelings because they're doing something about it. Whereas sadness feels more passive. Like when we're sad, we're being weak or we're being like Eeyore and we're just going to cry in our rooms with our like curtains closed. And it feels more like passive, like you're not going to, like you're not doing anything, like you're letting it take you over. Whereas people have the misunderstanding that anger is better because
you're
doing something with it.
Yeah.
And
you're getting it out. People also think that you're getting things out when you're angry. And that's not the case.
Well, and also, always. I mean, I argue that anger is never, I think of anger, you can disagree with me, as like a secondary feeling where I feel like very rarely are people just angry and anger is the root feeling. Usually it's something else like embarrassment, disappointment, fear. Like even in this book, I mean, in the movie, when they're talking about the it, which is kind of like the big bad
right.
of the movie. It's talked about, it's kind of like all your negative feelings in a representation. And they say, like, it makes people have fear, which turns into anger and violence and rage. And I was like, I really like that. Because that's how I always think of it, too, when people say they're really angry. I'm like, but what are you really feeling?
Because what are you hiding underneath
it's never
that?
It's never truly anger.
Right.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that.
Right. It's interesting how that gets represented in different movies, and like Nerd Alert, I picked up on that. It's the second I heard that, I was like, that sounds oddly familiar to Yoda right there.
Oh my gosh.
I wonder if that might have gotten borrowed.
Well, I was telling
this
Brittany,
book was written in the 60s, so
correct.
You can step off, nerd.
I meant that was this one borrowed by Star Wars. It's feasible to believe that might have been, because Yoda, fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, anger leads to suffering.
But here's the thing else I would say, though. Maybe it's one of those things where all these different fantastical things talk about it, because it's such a, I think it's a feeling we all understand, but we don't know how to actually do it in practice. Because I work with people of all ages where they, once we get to it, they know that they're not just angry. But it's just that feeling of anger being a power feeling or action feeling is so, people really glom to that.
They do.
It's comfort. It's a comfort. It's, for some reason, it gives comfort.
I mean, you've done a lot of, like, anger management stuff. I mean, is anger ever the root?
No.
No.
No, it's never. It's never the root. And, like, something that I think is especially important to mention is that I see it in men and boys, and having mm-hmm. grown up as a boy at one point in my life, mm-hmm. The
that's the legend.
This the legend, right? I may have grown up as a girl. I'm not sure, you know. Like, but when we talk about the way boys are socialized in our society and many others, mm-hmm. It's good that they showed this with a girl too, because that's girls aren't allowed like to have that same level of like anger, and it's punished harsher than when boys do it. Because boys, it's like accepted. And the other thing we have is mm-hmm. that for us, it's the only one that's allowed, not only by society but by our peers. Like mm-hmm. if you are sad on the mm-hmm. playground, you're about to get destroyed.
You're gonna get bullied.
You're gonna get your ass kicked. Like mm-hmm. flat out. Like you're gonna mm-hmm. call the pussy. You're gonna get called the mm-hmm. little bitch. Like somebody's gonna like they're gonna cue on you and they're gonna target you and try to make you cry again to take that control over
toxic
you.
Masculinity, y'all.
Absolutely, it's toxic masculinity.
I get what you're saying, too, now that we're talking about it. It is, considering that the book was written in the 60s, it's really, maybe because it was written by a woman, but it's really progressive that the main angry character is a girl, and then the two very open, sensitive characters are boys, mm-hmm. which is a really cool flip on gender roles, and just showing, boys being tender and acknowledging that girls can be angry people. Because I think that's something that really blows people's mind when girls are aggressive. They're like, ugh. It's like they don't know where to put that. Those two thoughts. That's cognitive dissonance right there. This girl's being aggressive. I mean, and even her principal is like, an adult is like, get your shit together. Your dad's been gone for 4 years, so move past it.
That
really bummed me out. But then she put him right in his place. Because, well, not intentionally. Because she said the world would make sense again. And I think that is that's a real thing with, like, people dealing with depression is... There's also the fantasy of if I can just fix one, if one external factor would change, then everything will be fine. Like if I lived somewhere else, or if I had a boyfriend, or if my dad was here, or like whatever, like if we just changed one thing, then everything would click into place. Because even, they don't really do it in the movie, which kind of bummed me out, but in the book, she has a whole existential freak out, kind of, because when they find her dad... Like, Charles Wallace still gets taken, it still is kind of going to shit, and she gets so despondent and angry with her father. They have a little moment of it, but in the book, a lot more where they have full-blown argument, because she's like, I found you, and you can't fix everything. And how can you not fix everything? And she's so angry with him in the book, and so upset that she finally found him, and it didn't click everything into place.
It's a really good example of having magical thinking, and really thinking that all I need is my dad. All I need is for the end of this story to end with my father, and if that's what happens, then everything else will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not... Because what needs to happen is you need to feel different about yourself, and accept yourself for who you are, and being okay with your experience. And mm-hmm. The way that she gets angry in the book totally makes sense, because I think that it's having that magical thinking just destroyed in front of you mm-hmm. in a way that you did not expect.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a lot of times why we'll see people after something, like, I finally got this job, or I finally got married, or I finally did this, and I still feel like shit, and what is the deal? And then they go see a therapist, because they're like, I did all the things, and I don't feel any better. And then they have a full-blown existential crisis on top of whatever mental health issues they were having.
Right, and if we just have kids, then our marriage will be fixed. If we just get married, then everything will be okay. If we just have money, everything will be okay. And it mm-hmm. it doesn't work that way. And this movie did a good job of like bringing that in to the point where, and Mrs. Witch was really good mm-hmm. at that, like bringing it back to the existential and like the truth of it, that you have to confront yourself. Which is her message, like, you have to confront you. You have to mm-hmm. deal with your darkness.
It's really cool that I really like books, well, stories, movies, book stories, where the person saves themselves. Where it's not, like, someone magical comes along, or when it's a woman role, when it's a man comes along and, like, saves them at the, the 11th hour.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it really hard, even, like, reading the book, to, like, not feel desperate about so I can imagine what kids feel like when they read it, is you're saying that none of the adults are going to help her, that she has to go in and do it herself. Like, it's a lot more poignant in the book because she's having a whole powwow with all the Mrs. and her dad, and they're to straight up say, it's got to be you.
You're the only one.
Yeah, and it's like, you're the only one who can do this. All these adults aren't able to fix it for her. I mean, it's a really powerful message about, like you said, like, to get better and feel better, you have to look inward. I mean, it's a pretty existential movie when you really think about
it. It's a very, very existential movie. It had strong themes of existential philosophy and cognitive behavioral philosophy, like, kind of tied together.
Well, I guess we should say, I don't know if existential is a... Do people... When we say existential, we mean, who am I? What am I? Where's my place in the universe?
That's what
we
mean purpose? By
existential. Existential is, like, the big questions. And when you're, like, don't have a sense of identity.
Right.
And the existential philosophy is all about, like, I think, therefore I am kind of stuff.
Right. I think, therefore I am. What is my place in the world? How do I fit in? It deals with basic fears, fear of being alone, fear of death, fear of being irrelevant. Yeah. These types of things.
And she has all those, Meg. I mean, she's pretty hopeless. In the beginning of this movie, she's kind of written herself off as a dummy who is gross looking and no one likes, and that's just how it is. And maybe she can help Charles Wallace be a better person, and maybe she can help her mom, but she can't help herself.
Right. Yeah. And then it was interesting that they used Calvin as kind of a foil to that.
Mm-hmm. Like direct, well, it's a direct confrontation of how she thinks about herself, which is why she acts like such a pill when he's like, hey, girl.
Right. Hey, girl. Like, hey, how girl, you hey. Doing?
And she's like, I don't know. How are you doing? Why? Are you asking? When she's like, let's hide behind the bushes. Oh, that poor girl.
Yeah.
But I really liked, talk about the existential theme, like, even with her bully, like, that they, when they talked about the it and how the it is all the negative feelings in the world, or in the worlds, and they showed her and all the weight stuff and all the rules she set for herself so that she can feel loved because her identity is wrapped up in being attractive and popular and thin and all those things. And so she's rolling around with all that chaos and self-hatred inside of her, which is why she's lashing out at Meg. Because, I mean, bullies are sad people. I mean, we like to think that bullies are just, like, huge evil douchebags.
Rotten to the core or something.
But kids who are bullies have something going on within them. Either they're being bullied by other people or themselves.
Right. There's something that they're dealing with that isn't being addressed. And like, I felt, like, one thing that I took a note on that profoundly bothered me with the movie was that they showed yet again this problem with our society where we punish the wrong person and get into the wrong person. Like, this person is defending themselves against the bully. Meg then, like, gets punished and brought in, like, well, you're the one that hit her.
It. Yeah, it's always who ends it.
Right.
Who we saw, whoever finished the fight.
Right, whoever finished the fight. Instead of what really needs to be done with addressing bullying is both of them.
Yeah. I mean, because when I talk to parents with kids who are acting out, I say, stop focusing on the behaviors and start focusing on the feelings behind the behaviors. Like, that doesn't mean that kids don't get consequences. Like, you can still say, hey, you did something bad. Like, that, like, you can't hit people, so you're going to lose this, this, and this, or you're going to be grounded. But don't put so much emotional weight on that. Kind of get past that. Just treat that very black and white.
Right.
And then be like, okay, so what was going on?
Right.
Because you want to do that. Like, process the feeling. Because that's the part that's, like, just punishing the behavior is, like, treating a symptom and not the actual disease.
Right. Well, and then, like, this problem results where you don't get the root addressed either. Like, you see this in schools a lot, or in homes, like, when there's one sibling that's more of a bully than the others, is that they only address the person that lashes out. So it's either you, as a victim, put yourself in a position where someone can see you getting victimized, but you still have to be victimized before you can get believed or getting attention or any real action is taken, or you act out and defend yourself, but then you're the one who's in trouble, and the person who did the bullying and was organizing other kids into making fun of you, which, like, isn't addressed. The teachers may see that and ignore it. And I felt that was something that I think really needs to be worked on, is when you do any kind of trauma work, particularly like when I worked in a residential school for kids, like you have to get trained in crisis management. And one of the mm-hmm. things that I did, they ascribed to TCI, therapeutic crisis intervention. And one of like the core components of that is the life space interview, which that takes space after the event. And it's like mm-hmm. what you were just talking about, mm-hmm. Brittany, with like the, like you have to process what happened.
Yeah.
It can't just be like, yes, there's a consequence. Mm-hmm. But if you just go like, you did this, so now you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't process the feeling behind it. Why did that happen? Mm-hmm. What happened? What went on with you? What were the feelings you experienced? Yeah. What could have happened to avoid this? What else could you have done? What else do you need so this doesn't happen? And I feel like the principal missed all of those key points and only attacking her problems and like blaming her for having feelings. Well, and that bothered me.
It's also hard. The easy way out. It's yeah, easy.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's harder work to do that work because also you have to be vulnerable and you have to be emotionally open and you have to be willing to take on this child's emotions as well and create a safe space. And I'm sure schools probably don't have the time, resources, training to do that kind of stuff. And not bad and some, on them, yeah. but it's just like crisis management probably all the time in terms of that kind of stuff.
Well, it's a similar systemic problem that's all over the place where nobody has the time or the energy to really do things like that, to make really big changes where to let schools have the time and the space for that.
Well, it's just everyone gets so stuck on the behavior. And feeling like the kid because is intentionally, like, being a dick.
I think it's because it gives adults a sense of control. Mm. They're doing this thing. I can stop that thing.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know if adults have... See. Exactly. That's what you can see. And that's so much how we're socialized. What you see and how you act. And that's what everybody knows. And that's what your reputation is. And all your identity around that.
Yeah. Oof, it's rough.
Yeah.
The amount of... times, because I've done work like in schools where I've talked to teachers and with parents, and I mean even my own self at times, like on weaker points, like you just be like, oh, why does it keep doing that? And you're just like, you get very stuck on, why does this kid keep blowing up their own spot and acting out? Why can't they just get it together and snap out of it? Like, why are they ruining everybody's day? Because it's just the emotional work is so deep rooted and so hard. And you have to just stay with it. It's just a lot of hard work. Especially with kids who are in turmoil. Like, she is in turmoil.
She is
in turmoil. And the movie did a good job of showing, like, how different kids may respond differently to things. Because they showed, like, all three kids are experiencing some sort of adverse event one way or another. Some sort of bullying.
Mm-hmm.
But they all three respond to it differently. So we covered like Meg pretty well, but what about Calvin? What do we see in him?
I mean, Calvin has a pretty heinous home life. He's the kind of kid that on paper has everything going for them, but has a lot of internal turmoil. Like, I think the way they handled that really well is when he made some comment and Meg was like, what are you talking about? You're popular and everybody likes you and you're good at basketball and da 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 da. Like in the book, even he's like really good. He's good looking. He's really good at sports. He's really good grades. Like he's like on paper, got it all together. And I think he's kind of the example of people who are able to present very well, even though they're having a lot of problems. And even though they might coast through life, quote-unquote, easier, they aren't also not getting what they need internally, which can present. I mean, he's a pretty resilient kid. I mean, he's also an example of some people are just way more resilient. And by that, I don't mean that as, like, a positive trait, like some kids can just get it together. I mean, some kids can magically just push through bad situations and not let it present in how they treat other people. Some people can just do it. It's almost like a miraculous, spontaneous occurrence with some people. That's what we say when we say resilience. But, I mean, even though there is, like, some deep-seated stuff, like, the amount he seems taken aback in the movie when he experiences unconditional love by Charles Wallace, by the whole Murray family.
Yeah.
He can't, like, believe it.
Yeah, the way, and I think I don't know that the movie does the best job of showing his intense kind of... because it changes the way that he thinks about everything. Like, he walks into that house and is like, I feel like I'm home.
I feel like mm-hmm. I don't understand.
Like when he's like, your like house I didn't know
that there was places that were like this.
Like he couldn't even name what he felt their house was full of, which
exactly.
was love.
Exactly.
He was like, your house is full of something.
Yeah, that idea of changing your being able to change your narrative and to not even know that there are stories out there like this, where you can be yeah. in a family that is loving and open and vulnerable and tender, and mm-hmm. that it's okay mm-hmm. and that it's safe, and he just can't.
Believe it.
He just can't believe it.
Right. The only thing that they showed for him was that, like, no matter that, you know, his mm-hmm. efforts to do well in school and to be a well-adjusted, well-liked, popular kid, that he wasn't accepted by dad.
By his dad.
Yeah, and he was, and like, his what dad his dad was screaming about was a B on the test.
Right.
It was, like, 82, which is a B. And his dad was still getting in his face, so God knows what his dad's getting. And it's the whole thing, maybe he's such a quote-unquote good kid because he's trying to prove himself to his dad. You know, and so there's that thing, too, where some people we praise and give a lot of props to because we think, oh, they really got together, when we don't realize the motivations of why they're such a good student or such a good boy, because they're trying to fill something up within them that they're not getting from their home, or they think they will get eventually if they can just find that puzzle piece as well.
Ugh. It was interesting, like, to show that, like, with Calvin, I thought it was good that you see different people adjust to different things differently. And mm-hmm. for some kids, like, even if they are dealing with all kinds of stuff at home and that they don't understand, mm-hmm. they're still going to present with, like, a positivity, and they're going to mm-hmm. adjust to things and be more well-adjusted differently. They may respond to or view the world differently and still be seeking out that love and try to find yeah. it, and may even, well, like, yeah. insert themselves into situations uh-huh. And attach easier than they should.
That's true. Calvin kind of jumps into it.
Correct.
And you could argue that he's, I guess, a people pleaser. He probably gives too much of himself to other people. I mean, even when Charles Wallace is reading him to filth in that one part, he says, you're just rescuing her because you can't, like, your dad doesn't love you and all that stuff. Which is true. I mean, and I think that gets painted as a positive a lot, when really those people are not saving enough for themselves. They're not saving enough love for themselves. They're giving it all to everybody else. Well, poor Calvin.
All right, and like, that was particularly interesting with him, like, mm-hmm. when they showed him on the beach with, like, he was the one, he wasn't able to taste the sand.
Mm-hmm. Like, he went right into it.
He went right into it.
Believing 100%.
100% that it.
That this was food, this guy's not trying to do anything to us, I'm hungry enough, and I'm going to believe that it's food, and I'm going to eat it.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was an just interesting.
Just going along and being complacent and you know, a good boy.
Right. Eat what's put in front of you, except mm-hmm. that, and, like, it was an interesting way to depict, like, his psychology of, like, being that pleaser, being that, mm-hmm. like, I'm being shown some sort of affection and love, so let me seek it out right now. And they showed that with, like, mm-hmm. the creepy families and the cul-de-sac and the scary mm-hmm. mother, and, like, I'm like, oh, come in, we'll give you food. He's like, I'm hungry. I could eat. Like, we could go for this. He's, like, yeah. seeking that acceptance yeah. and love. So, yeah. like you can see people who are abused who, like, seek that out. And when yeah. they're shown, like, any ounce of it, they don't do a good job of discerning mm-hmm. what is manipulation.
That's true, because they're just, like, starving
right.
for it.
Right. And they thought they did a good job of showing that with him, where you can, mm-hmm. if you're starving for that attention and that love and you're shown just a little bit of it, mm-hmm. people will latch on.
Which is, I mean, you could argue that's why he's even in the book, he, like, immediately just gloms on to their mission. I mean, in the book, there's more of a mysticism to it, where, like, he's feeling called, like, he's more, like, Charles Wallace-esque in the book, where he's kind of tuned in on a psychic level and more, like, open-minded, open-hearted, whatever, like, mm. whatever, however you describe that. But even then, he's just like, all right, like, he didn't know Meg, except for in school. And, you know, didn't know their family, and he was just like, all right.
Yeah, and I feel like he was easily, like, in the first, even in the opening scene when he comes into the book as well, like, he was in love with Meg immediately.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't he say?
I mean, like, he...
Yeah,
like,
I think it's, in the book, right. like, he even tells her he loves her.
Yeah, like, there is...
put in the movie.
Yeah, there is no doubt that it's, like, he immediately feels this connection with her, and which could maybe be part of his experience, or, like, part of his power, I guess. I don't really know how to talk about it, but mm-hmm. It could be part of that. But the fact that he doesn't know how to have any boundaries for himself because he's had such little experience of being loved in a way that makes sense, mm-hmm. or in a way that is actually feels mm-hmm. good, that he just accepts it, just opens up and accepts it 100%.
Because in the book,
which can be dangerous.
Because in the book, it's more him.
He's also a kid.
He makes multiple. He says multiple times in the book, like, "No one's missing me right now." And they're like, "Do your mom know where you are?" And he's like, "She does. She probably doesn't know I'm gone." Like, he says it multiple times in the book, and it's just that kind of, yeah, that thing where you just don't feel important. And, like, even though you've got all this stuff going on, if it doesn't mean anything to your parents or to the people that you get the most love from, then, because he kind of brushes off when she says, "But you're so popular." He's like, "Yeah, and?" Because it's not getting him what he needs. So what does it matter?
Right. Right. It's not getting him what he needs. It's not getting him the acceptance at home.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is something that this also touched on, like, even if you're getting it from the world, if you're not getting it from your primary supports,
yeah,
then it's not as powerful, and it's not as meaningful. Like, kids can, and adults, as they separate out into adulthood and reach later developmental stages, can learn to change who they identify as their primary support system, their primary family unit, but kids at this age particularly, like, need that support at home.
I mean, it's a cliche because it's true. People think the cliche in therapy is, oh, it's your parents or it's your mother. But it's like, a lot of times it's the truth, though, because we learn love and we learn connection and we learn vulnerability and we learn how to be open-hearted by the examples that our parents set for us, if only because they're our first role models in this world of how to be with other people, how to treat yourself. And so it's a cliche because it's true.
Well, because we learn from the environment that we're placed in, and what environment are we all in the longest? I mean, for most people, right? It's until you're 18 to some capacity, right?
Sometimes forever.
Yeah, exactly. So being in that similar setting and having the experience of being in that family and how that has such a big impact on everything in your life. I mean, to say that it doesn't have anything to do with it is just not accurate.
It's a cop-out. Yeah.
Because there's so many different things that we learn in our families and so many different lessons that we're taught about our feelings or emotions or anger or relationships that we replay as adults.
So Charles Wallace is kind of a magical enigma in the story.
Yeah.
I mean, you could argue maybe because he's so little, which is why maybe he's doing okay. You know, like, his dad left when he was so little, so, like, his life that he can recall has been without his dad.
Right.
Just being with his mom and Meg, and he thinks that they're the best, so...
Yeah,
he's very secure.
Very secure attachment to his mom and to his sister.
And it could be because he was so little.
Yeah.
When his dad left.
Yeah.
And he probably doesn't really remember it, which is something they talk more about in the book, but, like... Like, does he even know him as, like, his father?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And because he's so... I think what was some of the most heart-wrenching stuff, like, just on a visceral level in the movie, was when he shows very small things of tenderness. For some reason, like, there's a scene where they're on Mrs. What's-It when she's, like, that big leaf.
Right.
And he, like, went the way he, like, brushes past Mrs. Witch's face made me cry. And I was, like, taken aback by... how viscerally moving that was.
Yeah.
And I think it's because it's just showing, like, just how unguardedly tender he is.
How vulnerable he...
Like, it doesn't occur to him that that's, like, a weird thing to do. Like, he didn't second guess that. Like, he just kind of does what feels right and good and appropriate in the moment. Like, he's very in tune with his inner clock and, like, his intuition. And, like, that's why he's so sure of Meg, even though everyone's, like, was this girl's deal? He's like, no, she's good stuff. Like, I love her. She's got it in her. She's beautiful. She's smart. She's gonna grow out of this. And he's so sure of everything. And, I mean, I think
he's
kind of a magical made-up character for this book. I mean, to be honest, like, I don't know any other, like, 5-year-old that would be this self-actualized, but...
Yeah.
But he's a really good example of a counter-argument to Meg.
Yeah.
Having, like, that positive, which part of it could be because he's so precocious, or because in this world, he's clocked in to whatever the positive part of, like, wherever the counter part of it is, like, the light, he's just, like, really, like, in tune with it. So it's almost like he's an open receptacle for the light and for positivity and tenderness. Like, he's so sure of himself, which is also, but, why he gets sucked into the it, because he is so open-hearted, which I think is people's I mean, that's a big metaphor what people are worried about. Like, yeah. If I'm open-hearted and if I'm giving, then something bad will come in and take advantage of that.
Correct. And they show that pretty well, like, where the most in-tune character. And you see that. That's a pretty common archetype, is you mm-hmm. see is, like, the most open character, the most mm-hmm. gentle character is the one that everyone's trying to corrupt. And in, mm-hmm. in this movie, like, they actually show him getting corrupted. Mm-hmm. Like, the evil force, the... Mm-hmm. undesirable emotions of the mm-hmm. the universe are corrupting him and mm-hmm. Manipulating him to use that openness to be also open to the evil and lock into that. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a really good depiction of how that trope exists in these movies, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it just shows him turning so sharply, like he's mm-hmm. corrupted so quickly, like mm-hmm. once the Michael Pena's character comes in, like he starts mm-hmm. turning.
Yeah. Well, and also in the book they do a better job of illustrating how he's pretty cocky, though. Like, that's probably his one biggest downfall, Charles Wallace, is he knows he's smart, mm-hmm. and he knows he's got it going on, and so he's just like, I can do this, I can talk to the it, and I can get it all worked out. And that's why he's kind of an allegory for don't get ahead of yourself. In the book.
Sure.
And they even warn him. They don't do this in the movie, but in the book, they warn him, Charles Wallace, you will have the hardest time. It will be the hardest for you.
Because you're so open.
Because you're so... I think it's interesting, too, that he has such a, in a way, an easier time in the world, right, on mm-hmm. Earth. And then he comes to this place, and it's like, the food he's eating tastes like sand. He walks right into the trap that is set for him immediately. Like, mm-hmm. he doesn't know... In some ways, I wonder if it's because sometimes people who haven't... Not that he hasn't had to experience things, yeah. but especially the character in the movie, who isn't bullied for being not talking and all the things that happen in the book, actually, mm-hmm. not having experience with adversity a mm-hmm. lot can sometimes make you more vulnerable or harder to understand what's happening. When you hit an obstacle, it's harder for you to reel back and be able to take a step versus Meg, mm-hmm. right, has had this experience, kind of knows what this mm-hmm. feels like.
Well, and that's what works for her in the end, which is
right.
she's like side-eyeing the whole situation. She's like, I don't trust this, I don't like that, I'm not doing it, I refuse. And that is what saves her. But I also think that's part of Charles Wallace being so young, is you yeah. have very black and white thinking when you're that little.
Yeah.
And very good and bad, and doable, undoable. Like, it's, you get, I mean, it's just, that's part of his, I mean, that's probably where he's most immature in the books, which is just, everything's good. Everything will be good. Like, that naivete, I guess, is the word for it, about
well, even the whole him, situation. Even him meeting the misses and just... feeling like they're safe, and even though maybe that's part of his part power of his captain, yeah. yeah, part of him being, you know, aware of everything, but like him just going with them and letting them into the house and all of those things, like that same idea of like the same thing with Calvin, where once we have something you mm-hmm. just keep going and you just keep letting it happen. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know, it's just it's tricky.
Yeah,
his relationship with Meg is beautiful, though.
Their unconditional love for each other yeah. is very beautiful. And the way that they're so tender with each other, and they're the so way sure of each other. Even if when Megan's not sure of anything, but she's sure about him.
Yeah.
And I think that's what saves her, too, is she's sure about his love for her. Which is a very beautiful, beautiful moment in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, realizing that just you can have faults and still be loved. Because I think it's also that black and white thinking of, I can't be... all these things and also be loved, and realizing that you can be all your faults and be loved. I think that's where people get very stuck. Even adults I work with get very stuck. Like, I have to be better at this, this, and this before someone can love me.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's yeah. that's 100% where they get stuck. And I think if we start to shift into like what we would do with these characters were we to have them mm-hmm. In our offices, I think that's an important like component of mm-hmm. like treatment philosophy and learning how to understand mm-hmm. like how we would move forward. So if you were to have Charles Wallace come into UCU after all this event, what do you think would be your approach with him?
I mean, I guess it's really hard how he's presenting after. I mean, I think he'd probably be really thrown. So I think it might be working on like processing. Probably be a really good little processor talking about everything.
He would.
Oh yeah, he'd be so amazing
at it. Oh my god,
he'd be so adorable. And magical. I think it would be all like, well, one, he might have some adjustment issues with his dad being back and how that'll change up the dynamic in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Because he only knows that.
Yeah.
And two, kind of processing that something really bad has happened to him that kind of blew up his belief system probably. And kind of processing, okay, now what do you do with those feelings? But honestly, I mean, I don't... When I was thinking of treatment, I was thinking more with, like, Meg and how to process her feelings and how feelings aren't scary. Like, you kind of talked about the volcano thing, Ben. There's right. this really cool kid, but she's a little too old for it. Maybe Charles Wallace's age would be more appropriate. There's a really cool book called Me and My Volcano, which I use a lot with kids before. It's a workbook, and it talks about how you have feelings. Everyone has feelings, and either you can be a safe volcano or an unsafe volcano, because either way, you're going to have feelings that are going to need to come out of you. So it doesn't act like you don't have feelings and you don't need to erupt in some fashion. And so it really validates feelings and talks about either you can be a safe volcano that lets steam off appropriately so that animals don't get hurt and people don't get hurt and plants don't get hurt when you erupt. Or you can be an unsafe volcano, shove, shove, shove until you blow up and then everything around you gets hurt. And then it talks about coping skills. It's like a real, like, piece-by-piece workbook that's really good with littler kids because it's very drawing-based and it's very simplistic and very metaphorical. And, but I think it's that thing where you can let off steam. You can have your feelings in little bits and pieces in a way that's appropriate that makes you feel better. It doesn't have to be shove, shove, shove. And I think with Meg, just, like, letting her being able to acknowledge the big, hard truths, kind of like we talked about. Like, what's the big fear? What's the big irrational feeling? And kind of just getting through that. I think that would be the most, the first step, the first epiphany, I guess, first breakthrough that would lead to everything else.
Yes.
Which is, let's absolutely. Just get it, let's just say the big scary thing we're scared of saying. And then she'll say it in therapy, and then I don't eat her up, the couch doesn't swallow her,
mm-hmm.
like, everything keeps going. So I think a person will say it, and you can see the agony and relief on their face simultaneously when they finally admit the big scary thought. Usually it comes with a lot of crying, which is good and fine. But just getting it out and having it be said to somebody else and just have it not be a secret anymore.
You don't have to hold on to it anymore.
And that by itself, yourself. The relief of that can lead to progress just skyrocketing. But you kind of have to get past that. But she's got to be willing to say it. But so you would start with a lot of coping skills, a lot of creating a safe structure. I mean, Meg's probably the kind of kid that I would see in therapy and we just stare at each other for, like, the first few weeks together.
Yeah. A lot of... It may take that. It yeah. may take that use of silence of...
Yeah. Because a lot of...
Absolutely.
People, like parents, when they bring their kids in, will get really frustrated when it's like that. But I'm like, what I try to right. tell them is, a lot of times kids are not in therapy because they woke up one day and were like, I'd like to be self-actualized. Let's get a name of a therapist. A lot of kids are in therapy because they're feeling forced to be in therapy. And so what I try to encourage parents to do is, it's okay if the first few sessions is them just feeling me out. And if we need to play games or if we need to just sit and stare at each other, I'm in no rush. Like, there is no rush. Like, the kid needs to get comfortable with me, and then we can start doing the work.
But and some, it needs yeah. to be part of where the kid wants to go, too. Yeah. And I feel like that's something, like, I feel your frustration when we have our group meetings where we well, talk about
parents,
stuff.
I mean, parents, God bless them, they're well-intentioned, but right. well-intentioned agendas sometimes, because you're seeing something within the kid that you know is holding them back or causing them great pain. And so you're like, okay, we're going to get this therapist in, we're going to talk about this thing, so I can see it.
Right.
But you seeing it isn't what's powerful.
No.
The kid has to see it, recognize it, and want to work through it.
Right. And the parent has to be allowing of that process to exist and understand that, like, that process may take time, and it may mm-hmm. take you as the therapist quite a bit of skill and work mm-hmm. to allow the kid to let yeah. you have that crack so the light can get in, to no, stick with the metaphors yeah. of this movie.
I mean, a lot of it is just maybe shooting the shit, talking about stuff that they like, talking about safe topics, playing games together. So a lot of, I know sometimes people will get frustrated with me as a child therapist, because they'll be like, I'm paying you the $30 copay so you can play Uno with my kid for, like, a month straight. And I'm like, well, the kid's feeling me out. And the kid's realizing I'm not another adult who's... Because when you come at them with questions and the hard stuff right immediately, they're just like, who are you? What's your agenda? I don't have to tell you secrets. I'm a stranger. I'm an adult stranger to these kids.
Right.
And they need to get comfortable with me. And part of that work is kind of just what feels like bullshitting around for, like, the first few sessions.
A little bit.
Okay. And I think a lot of times, hand in hand with that, is psychoeducation with the parents. A lot of times I'll talk to the parents a little bit in the beginning of every session or at the end of every session. So they kind of know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. Sometimes I'll even preface that when I'm doing my intake, my first session with a parent. I'll be like, hey, listen, so the first couple sessions might look like this, depending on how your kid's reacting to me. Like, right. We might be playing board games and talking about school or sports or dancing or hair. And that's because the kid has to be comfortable with me. And also, and like I kind of talked about already, is what the kid is behavioral as Meg, kind of encouraging the parents to stop focusing on the behavior. Because here's the thing, the kid already probably usually thinks they're a bad kid who only can do bad things. So you continue to focus on the behavior and making that the narrative and the kid's identity.
Then all you're doing is validating that. You're just
confirming that for them. Correct. And so back off of the behavior stuff, and instead when a kid's yelling at you, this is what I use with the parents, when your kid's screaming at you, say, hey, what's going on right now? Did something happen? How are you feeling? Like, because one, that'll take a kid back, because it's really hard to argue someone who is being calm with you. You kind of just feel like a doof and you stop. But also, you're making the kid stop and rethink what's happening. It's almost like you're shocking him a little bit, but also you're making the conversation different. It's not about fighting anymore.
Yeah.
It's about, hey, I'm here for you. And they might freak out on you because you're being vulnerable, and so they might panic and act out more or run away. But reconfiguring the conversation around, hey, 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 what's making you yell right now? Instead of, hey, 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 stop yelling.
Yeah.
Because that's a conversation starter. That's not a conversation. And that's not the kid learning anything different either. Because also what you're teaching the kid in the moment is, like, I can respond to you being aggressive by being calm and being open. Because when you yell back, you're just saying this is the only way to respond to someone who's being aggressive and being angry is by yelling or shutting them down. And so you're modeling for the kid that you can respond differently to someone getting in your face.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're not letting them get away with it. Like I said, you still can give them consequences. Like after you have the talk or before you have the talk, be like, hey, you did this. What? That's not okay. But, and a lot of times what I'll have parents do is create like a very concrete set of rules. There's no arguing about it. Like yelling gets 10 minutes time out or no phone or whatever you however you want to do it. And so there's no argument anymore about the punishments or why they're there. Like that's already agreed upon and you just get that out of the way. And then you can just do all the feelings work, like the talking about it after that.
Right. Okay. So this movie also had and this story has a pretty strong component in family. So Hannah, if you were to get this family, what do you think would be an important thing you want to see done for this family as far as therapy for them?
I think that if I had them in my office, I think, after the movie, right? So right. After the movie, the dad comes back. I think it would be a lot about healing from the dad being gone and helping them understand and also helping them kind of process their feelings together as a family and giving all of them their own voice in the situation, like all of the kids and mm-hmm. the parents, and helping them heal as a family unit, their dynamic. So
even
that
though they might be happy to see him, there still might be anger that they're not.
I mean, I think they showed even at the end of the movie with Meg and her dad, her kind of still feeling this, all these angry, confused feelings, whether it was about him not being able to save Charles Wallace or him leaving and maybe his ambition getting in the way of being an integral part of their family unit in some ways for that amount of time, even though it's very clear it's not intentionally done. Mm-hmm. But still, there's still all those thoughts and feelings that they all went through for 4 years. And and really being able to help them heal as a family, I think would be really important, not only for the kids, but also to model, this is something, when something big like this happens, we can get help and we can do something about it. And we can change our story as a family. We can change our narrative and how this is going to go. Because look, as a unit, if you think about them coming in, like, what's it going to look like when they go back to school? Or your dad just got sick of his girlfriend? I mean, like, they need to have an understanding and feel comfort in their family.
Yeah.
Because they're probably going to have a lot of questions and a lot of the world is going to have a lot of ideas about what happened. And so being able to protect them as a family, I think, would be really important to help kind of continue to cultivate Meg's positive image of herself and Charles Wallace, because he really got thrown off. I mean, this is a whole different story for him. This is a confident little guy.
Right.
And he goes and just gets annihilated immediately and taken over and is lost immediately. Right. And him having that experience and the mom not being aware, even just processing what happened when they went to get the dad.
she didn't know anything about it. She might feel bad. She might have anger and shame and need to feel vulnerable with her husband. I mean, we're talking probably family sessions, probably couple sessions, just with the two of them, because I'm sure there's things that they would have to talk about.
Absolutely.
And forgive each other. Like, she might have to really work hard to forgive him for being gone for that long.
Even if it wasn't intentional,
there's still...
Resentment? We feel resentment even when we know intellectually not to feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would be, so I think that, and then on top of, like, some individual, I think the dad would probably need to see a therapist.
The guilt.
Just to process all his, and I'm sure that, again, it doesn't seem as though it was intentional, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't feel like he did it on purpose.
Well, because his choices led him there.
Yeah.
And that would probably be his
Yeah,
role.
So that's what right. I that's what I think I would do. So I think we're looking at a little bit of role-playing. I would probably do role-playing with them. Maybe having Meg play her dad and have the dad act like Meg. Like, I think it'd be really interesting to get their own perception. And again, how can they tell the story in their family setting to be able to heal?
Right. I mean, that's something that I did a lot of, like, studying on in grad school. Is one of the things that I learned a lot about and did some training in is psychodrama. And I think, like, using that psychodrama is, it's an improv-based therapy. It's therapy through acting. And one of the important components of it is, like, exactly what you're talking about, where it encourages people to take on the role of someone else in their family or have someone else from the group play units of their family so that they have to react to it in the moment, but they can also get, they have to spend some time with the other actor describing to them their perception of how the other person feels, and then they may use something like a role reversal, which would go into, like, even compound what you were saying, is like, make, like, Meg play, and Dad switch roles and play, where in order to fully, like, take on that role and be present in the moment and take on the ability to behave as another person, you have to learn to think like them. And in psychodrama, one of, like, the theories with that is that in doing that, you take on the ability to use your sense of the world, the Jungian type of, like, archetypes that we're all aware of. Like, we're all born with these, at least according to his theory, like, we're all born with the ability to understand all these roles. Mm-hmm. And in order to fully, like, understand and embrace one, acting as if you're in that role will activate different thoughts for you. And, like, going through that kind of role for that family, that would be hugely important. Or for the kids to play mom, because I think something we haven't talked about a little bit is with mom, like, one of the things in parents, you might see, like, mom wasn't able to solve this problem.
No.
Like,
no.
She was caught up in her stuff, and there might be some pretty significant guilt in there for mom. Like, I wasn't able to solve this problem for my kids.
Absolutely.
My kids recognized that I was weak, and they went and solved it for me. And parents often have, like, some pretty significant guilt about that.
Yeah, I think, so one of the other things that I don't know if you guys have heard of is called sculpting.
Mm-hmm.
And
what
that is when you have one member of the family kind of set up the family in a story, or, like, in a setting, like, this is what it looks like when we're in the living room together, and you have them kind of talk about each person, and they physically move them. They physically move them over, put their hands like how they usually are. It's really, I've actually seen it done when I was an intern with this really big family that was blended, and it was, like, the 10-year-old. And also, the other thing that does is it gives control to somebody who doesn't normally have control. And gives you the perception, again, trying to understand what do they view. So it's really interesting in different settings, it can be really interesting to see how Charles Wallace views it, or how Meg sees it. Does Meg put her mom and her dad outside in a different room? And it's just her and Charles Wallace, and that's all that she can see. Like, so I think another way, kind of going off of that, so that's another technique that maybe I would use, or another idea. I don't know how to describe it. Technique doesn't sound right, but anyway. So.
Yeah, no, that's okay. So, one of the things I wanted to cover, like, if I had Meg in my office, I really liked the messages that the four metaphysical beings kind of portrayed, and they kind of came across in different ways, and they came across using different themes of both cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a therapy based on the idea that our thoughts can influence our emotions, which influence our behaviors, but not one of them is more important than the other, necessarily. Like, by changing your behavior, you can change your thought, you can change your feeling. You can manipulate all three of those in any way. They're kind of in a triangular
loop. Yeah, when I draw it, a lot of times I'll draw it for people, and I'll draw it like a circle, because a lot of people understand, like, cycles, and I said, so you can jump into this cycle at any time you, at any place.
Right.
And then once you kind of break out of it, you start creating a new cycle, a positive cycle.
Right.
Because it's just actions equals behavior, well, behaviors equals feelings equals thoughts that just kind of go round and round.
Right, they go round and round, and one of the things that I'll do, like, similar to that is I will draw that cycle for them, and I'll talk to them, like, so if you keep this going, like, this same cycle is going to repeat over and over again, so I'll draw, like, help them, like, to draw a line, like, which point do you think you can draw a line to start making that new cycle?
Yeah,
like,
because people jump in at different points. Some people can change their behaviors or their thoughts. You kind of have to let them lead you with that.
Right. Like, changing the feeling is usually the harder part, but changing your thought or the behavior about something is important. I help them people understand that, depending on how your thoughts are, there's three levels of thought, right, that CBT will address. There's the automatic thought, which is something I felt like this movie did a pretty good job of addressing, particularly with Meg.
Absolutely.
And what automatic thoughts are and why they're powerful is those are the first thing to pop in your head.
What's your gut reaction?
What's the right now? But the thing about the right now thought is that it's not right.
It's usually the most toxic thought.
It can
or feeling.
It can certainly be the most toxic thought or feeling, and it's something that's often based in, like, survival instinct or, like...
It's your lizard brain, as I like to say.
Right. It's your right-now reaction, but, like, you have the opportunity to accept or reject that.
Yeah.
And I actually had a meeting with a client yesterday who was talking about that, like, what this client got from that movie. She had just watched the movie and she was talking about that, like, I got pretty moved by that, like, recognizing, like... seeing what happened with Charles Wallace in it, and that, like, you could either choose to accept or reject, like, those darkness thoughts, the thoughts from the it controlling your mind, and, like, that can really influence how you feel. And, like, the way she interpreted it was kind of like the it was, like, some of, like, the automatic thoughts and, like, locking into the direction that took with you. But, like, CBT is helping people learn to recognize that, hey, let's take a second and recognize that there's a couple things at play here. So there's the three levels, like I was saying. Like, the automatic thought is the first thing that pops into your head, and oftentimes the only thing people evaluate their reactions based on. However, there's also schemas, which are categories of thoughts and ways you've grouped together information.
Yeah.
And those can be true or not, but there's often multiple categories. Like, the way your brain groups things together is you don't just think about one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. Like, once you get a schema, like, you categorize information so that you can pull a file. Like, if you were searching in your computer for things and you wanted to find certain information that goes together in a group, you put together, like, if I said baseball team, like, there's a couple things that go together that you would put in an order that go, like, okay, these facts put together mean this is a baseball team.
Yeah.
And then you have, beyond that, even deeper, you have core beliefs.
Yeah.
And core beliefs, like, those are the hardest thing to change. And with Meg, like, she probably has reached a point where some of her core beliefs, like, we've talked about pretty thoroughly. I'm unlovable. Mm-hmm. I'm not worthy.
I'm not smart. When I talk about it with clients, I talk about it as the map in your brain.
Yeah.
And that sometimes the road is made of cement, and sometimes it's a dirt road.
Right.
And sometimes we really got to break up that cement and, and get it changed so we can make another road. But that it can take time. That's the way that I talk about it sometimes, which sometimes can be helpful to help people, because it's a hard thing to kind of understand sometimes the different ways that our brain processes things and the different ways our physiological response has to do with how our thoughts and ideas are shaped.
Right. And it has a lot to do with it. So, like, if I were to get Meg, like, I would start with CBT, much like Mrs. Witch did, particularly with her, like, helping her to understand, you know, that, like, you have to change the way you think about these things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was a lot of these little, like, almost like CBT type of techniques that you would see with therapists cover with somebody, like, altering the thought just a little bit.
Yeah, what, like, because sometimes people can't go right to, like, the positive counterpart of their thought, but they can get to more of a neutral space.
Right.
Right.
Like, sometimes they're not ready to replace, like, I am dumb with I am smart, but you could just say I'm not dumb, you know, or just like, or you know,
right, or I'm not dumb all the time.
I was gonna say I'm more like, kind of giving, yeah, like never, always, changing those to sometimes,
right,
and being able to see that sometimes, well, maybe it isn't always never or always,
right,
kind of getting to, like, creeping, like, doing it in increments. to the positive.
Well, again, having to learn how to be comfortable, right, with having different thoughts and ideas about ourselves, and with being comfortable being vulnerable in those places, mm-hmm. instead of having our defense reactions or mechanisms pop up of being angry and acting out, mm-hmm. because we don't know how to process or what to do with the feeling or the action that's happening around us.
Right. And many therapists, many of the theorists throughout the years have come up with different ways of relaying the same information. Like, I thought that Mrs. What's-It did a good job of using what Adler would call spitting in soup, with mm-hmm. telling her, like, to you, I give you the gift of your faults.
Paradoxical thinking.
Right.
Yeah.
She threw it, like, right in there of, like, mm-hmm. poisoning the idea that she had that mm-hmm. her faults were bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, like, the concept of spitting in your soup means. It's like, people will serve themselves, like, the idea he came out, like, mm-hmm. people serve themselves this soup. It may not be the most healthy thing, but it's the thing that they've
mm-hmm.
understand, and they know it's good mm-hmm. for them, they understand. And, like, by changing that just a little bit, by ruining it, like, and then still making them, like, confront it and eat it, yeah. they have to confront the fact that maybe I'm eating poison here.
Yeah.
And, like, she flipped it on her, and I thought that was done in a good way, like a therapist might have done, is, like, let's change that perception just a little bit.
Yeah.
Just enough to the point where you have to flip how you think about that.
Yeah, she made it Meg's responsibility.
Yeah.
To come up with that on herself. Like, she kind of, like, led her there. I mean, which is, like you said, like a therapist does. Like, we don't give people the answer.
Advice.
We try to help them lead it, because it's a lot more powerful when it comes from you.
Right. Or, well, that was what a good therapist does.
Yeah, true. Bad therapists give advice is the motto.
Correct. And you see that's a trope you see in movies. It's like therapists, like, giving advice and, like, guiding people. And then people come to us, like, seeking that. But, like, when you see real change happen, it's not because of something that I did directly.
Yeah.
It's because you came to me and worked with me. And what I would want to do with Meg is similar to what those metaphysical beings did with her, which is help her to understand that you have the power to accept who you are
mm-hmm.
and to take all that is you
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
use all that is you, good and bad,
mm-hmm.
to change the direction of your life and realize that it's okay for you to be imperfect,
mm-hmm.
and your imperfections come from somewhere, and you can use those. They don't have to exist in a negative context.
Well, it's challenging that all-or-nothing thinking.
Right.
Like, I'm all bad, or I'm all good, and Charles is all good, and Calvin is all good, and that girl at school is all good, and I'm all bad.
Right. And once they were able to have her confront that, I think it was important, the CBT's, like, side of things. And then if I were to, like, move deeper, and my, like, general philosophy with clients is, like, I kind of think of it like a bee sting, almost, mm-hmm. like, you know, the way I'm going to approach treatment. Like, when you get someone who's stung by a bee, oftentimes the stinger goes into the skin, but mm-hmm. the poison sac sits on top.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just try to pull that out,
mm-hmm.
like, you're going to squeeze more poison into the wound,
mm-hmm.
more of the venom. So you have to scrape the poison sac off. So you CBT to scrape the poison sac off, and then get into more existential type of thought to pull the thorn out and let the wound heal. Because like some of the trainings that I've done, especially EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, has the view that the brain will heal itself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that
the brain is a magical thing.
It is. And
it,
like, the
really
human
is. It really is. And the way that different people, the way that it just, for everybody, it's just so different. And the way that it gets processed and the way that we manage things and deal with things and how much it has to do with our environment and our experiences and also just the chemistry that's up there to begin with, what we start out with. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's magical. A brain is magical.
Well, just the brain can be damaged from trauma and bad experiences, but it can heal itself.
Right, but it can't heal itself while something is blocking it. Right, well, much like a cut to your hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like,
therapists are so corny. I use the splinter metaphor. Like, you got a splinter and it's sore when it's in your arm, and it may hurt more coming out. But then once it's out, you still feel sore, but then you can start healing.
I don't think I even have one like that.
I also have the one where you can wash a wound out, and washing the wound out can be the most hurtful part of it, but then you can start healing.
I just talk about it being harder. It's going to be harder before it feels better, but part of that is setting in that and processing that and dealing with that. And that's okay.
And
it's okay.
Feeling that feeling.
To feel this feeling. It's okay. But I want to, and kind of what I say is, which I think you guys is pretty similar, is I'll hold the hope for you. Mm-hmm. I will hold the hope for you in this room, mm-hmm. and we will get through it. And it does feel, it's going to not feel good for a little while, but then the end product is going to be so much different and something that you can't even see right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hold on to that for you.
So, final thoughts?
Final thoughts. I fucking love this movie. I just saw it yesterday. I feel like I already want to see it again. It just does such a beautiful job of showing what accepting yourself can do.
Like, in a very visual way.
In a very visual way.
The way she tests hers in the beginning versus the way she tests hers at the end is such a visceral representation of embracing yourself and enjoying yourself and enjoying all the parts of yourself.
Yeah.
And I think this would be, I mean, I don't remember a lot of it when I read it when I was a kid, but even reading as an adult, like, recommending it to kids going through a similar situation, like, I think she's such a relatable character, Meg. Like, all of the thoughts are feelings are things that I could recognize, even as, like, a grown woman, and just how we make stories about ourselves in our heads, and we just keep pumping them up and pumping them up and pumping them up. And I think it's just a really good, I mean, when we were in the theater, there was that little 12-year-old girl next to Hannah that was, like, really crying. And
she was really feeling it.
She was, like, what she was hitting on with the movie.
Yeah.
But, like, I guess my hope is that kids will watch, especially girls will watch it, and, I don't know, get that lesson of self-love and acceptance.
Yeah. I mean, I have hope that kids will watch it, and either gender will have so many good, positive things that are shown. How special it is to feel really close to your sibling, and how it doesn't matter what your anatomy is, you are allowed to express emotion and feel emotion and be vulnerable. And it's just that they do a really good job of that part, I feel like.
And embracing tenderness and vulnerability and, absolutely, you know, all that stuff.
I thought the message of the movie was really good. I thought some parts of it were rushed. Like, I read some reviews, and overall, like, I wasn't in love with the movie. I thought it was well done, and I thought it was an excellent kids' movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from the standpoint of an adult, like, I felt it was rushed and that there was a lot more that could be explored.
Yeah.
But also, I feel like we're a little bit spoiled now in the way we approach movies versus TV, because we consume them so differently now, because now things are streamed, and you can have a whole season or several seasons worth of character development that you see over, like, 20 hours, as opposed to, like, 2 hours you get in a movie.
Yeah.
So it's, like, some of the criticism, a little biased on that. Like, for a kid's movie, for the attention of a kid, like a 110-minute movie or whatever to cover this, I thought it did a great job. And what I really liked about it was that it showed how important it is to learn to accept faults and negatives and balance into your life, which is, like, where it's, like, some of the existential components we, like, touched on come from. Like, learning to accept that good and bad both make up part of who you are, but that you can choose to reject the overall arching negative, accept your faults, and learn that if something has hurt you, that's a way for healing to come in. Like, a wound is where light comes in? Is that, what was the phrase?
A wound is where the light comes in, yeah.
Yeah, like, learning to, like, accept that thought of just because you've been wounded doesn't mean you're broken forever. That it's a way for you.
I think that's a very powerful message, is, like, damaged goods kind of thing.
Right.
I think Meg really sees herself as damaged goods.
Right. As damaged person, like, forever.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's never going to get better. Like, there's the hopelessness,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of the worst symptoms of depression, like, clinically researched, period. Like, it's the one that's tied most closely to suicide. And, like, when you talk about, like, this movie and its ability to change that perception and learn, like, that the hopelessness and worthlessness that get tied together so strongly, that just because you're damaged doesn't mean you're worthless, and that you can change, you can allow healing to exist, and once you do that and you confront the things that are scary and are hard rather than avoiding them, that you can then return to, like, a better life.
Well, I just love movies that respect that kids have very deep, complicated emotions.
Yeah.
And conflicting emotions. And then even at the end, she has so many complicated things about her dad. Like, it wasn't like we found him. It was magical. Everything worked out. And it was fine that they had the space for her being disappointed and mad at him, on top of being happy and distraught and, like, all those complicated feelings. Like, I really love when anything respects that kids are emotional beings. and that their feelings are real.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a good movie. I recommend it. I recommend it as a movie to see with kids, for sure.
Yeah.
To end like a book to recommend to kids, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I don't see it as like a movie expecting it to be on an adult level, like a deep level where you're expecting to see like the full flesh out, the full like journey of the characters, the development you might see over like the course of a longer movie or a drama show.
A series of movies or right. something, yeah.
I would argue, though, that I cried like 8 times during this movie, so even if I get what you're saying, yeah. but I think the core visceral feelings of it are very poignant. And I don't know, maybe it was speaking to the little girl in me.
Same. I cried really hard and my shirt was wet. So clearly it touched something. And I think that it's just, it was just a really beautiful way and something that we just don't see that much of, honestly. I mean, it's been better lately, but anyway. Well, we hope that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, and follow us on Instagram at Popcorn Psychology. We also have a Gmail, popcornpsychology@gmail.com. If you have any thoughts, feelings, arguments, suggestions for other movies to do, and also subscribe to our podcast.
Yeah, please be sure to follow us and reach out with anything at all, and we'll catch you on our next episode of Popcorn Psychology.